from socialservice.sg, I'm Jing Yao, co-hosting today's episode with Isaac. Centered on the Singapore government's plan to enact new legislation to prohibit workplace discrimination, the Association of Women for Action and Research, or AWARE, published a position paper with recommendations to address gaps in coverage and implementation related to the tripartite guidelines on fair employment practices. Today, we speak with two people who are part of the team behind the position paper, Apurva and Daryl, asking them about AWARE's advocacy for anti-discrimination in the workplace, their thoughts about the Tripartite Committee's proposals and various forms of workplace discrimination. We'll also provide a link to the position paper in the show notes. Apurva is an executive at AWARE's Workplace Harassment and Discrimination Advisory, or the WHDA, which supports victim survivors of workplace harassment and discrimination and advocates for workers' rights in Singapore. A lawyer and activist, Daryl recently returned to Singapore after completing his master's in law on a Fulbright scholarship at UC Berkeley, where he wrote his thesis on the evolution of Singapore's approach to workplace discrimination. Relatedly, in our last episode, we spoke to Max So from the Disabled People's Association on related topics for people with disabilities, which you should check out if you have not already done so. Finally, if you have faced discrimination or harassment at your workplace, contact WHDA at 6777-0318 from Monday to Friday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. or email them at whda@aware.org.sg. You can also follow AWARE on social media on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Apurva, Daryl, thank you for joining us today. Maybe to start, to help our listeners get acquainted, could we invite the both of you to introduce yourselves briefly and how you're involved in AWARE's position paper on a legal framework for workplace and discrimination. So maybe let's start with Apurva first. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Yeah, hi, Janelle. My name is Apurva, and I'm an executive at AWARE's Workplace Harassment and Discrimination Advisory. So this is where I provide practical and emotional support to anyone who has been through these issues. Some of the types of cases that we see, you know, bulk of our discrimination cases are maternity related. Along with that, we also see quite a few cases related to workplace sexual harassment, as well as workplace harassment and bullying. So for this position paper, I provided insight based on our experiences with clients at WHDA, as well as AWARE's previous research on workplace discrimination and harassment.
And to remind folks, WHDA would be AWARE's Workplace Harassment and Discrimination Advisory. Thank you. Daryl, introduce yourself. And you've been here, you've been on the podcast before, but introduce yourself and in particular, tell us how you were involved in this this position paper.
Thanks, Junior. It's really nice to be back on this podcast. So I was very honored to have been able to work with AWARE on developing this position paper, and how it really kind of kick-started was I was speaking with some of the AWARE team about this forthcoming legislation. And at that time, I was doing my master's in UC Berkeley, and I was writing my thesis specifically on the development of employment discrimination law and policy in Singapore. So I was particularly interested, or rather I was concerned, because at that time, the government had put out some feelers suggesting that this legislation would only enshrine the existing TAFEP guidelines. So I was quite concerned, you know, that perhaps it's important for civil society to coalesce around the forthcoming enactment of this legislation to try to make sure that this legislation would be as comprehensive and effective as possible. So just maybe also to share a little background about myself, I'm a lawyer and activist. Previously, I've been quite involved with queer feminist and disability activism, with AWARE, with the Disabled People's Association, and also with Uga Chaga. So I worked with some of these organizations on advocacy research and also on their UN advocacy.
Thank you, Daryl.
So for the position paper, which we'll link in the show notes, it's quite detailed. So for our listeners, could maybe both of you give us a brief overview on what are the core recommendations that AWARE is proposing for the legal framework?
Yeah, our recommendations were based on existing anti-discrimination legislation in other countries, as well as aspects of Singapore's current anti-discrimination laws that we feel have room for improvement. And the key recommendation that we're really making is to protect every employee against all forms of workplace discrimination and at all stages of employment. And this comprehensive scope is really important because discrimination does not always look the same from person to person, and each case has to be addressed fully. So along with that key recommendation, we also recommend that victim survivors are exempt from certain requirements under the current Employment Claims Act, so particularly mandatory mediation. And we will talk a little bit more later about why this mediation first model is not really ideal for victim survivors in our experience at WHDA. And we also recommend that the Tripartite Alliance for Fair and Progressive Employment Practices, or TAFEP for short, we would want that to be established as a statutory body under the Ministry of Manpower. This would be called the Commission for Workplace Discrimination and Harassment, or the CWDH. This would be similar to existing bodies in other countries. For example, the US has the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission that has the power to enforce these discrimination laws in their country. And, you know, in the future, we would want to see the CWDH take on this role of engaging and educating the public as well on the legislation to make sure that it is implemented in an effective way.
Maybe just to jump off what Apurva has shared, I think it's really a long time coming for Singapore to enact this legislation. I think AWARE and many other civil society organizations have been calling for this legislation. And for a really long time, the government has resisted this step for a variety of different reasons. So it's really exciting that Singapore will finally be joining the vast majority of countries which already have such legislations in place. And for a country that, you know, prides ourselves on, you know, ideas of meritocracy, of multiculturalism, I think this legislation is really right step as Singapore moves towards realizing these ideals. And that's precisely also why I think we have put this position paper together, because we want to make sure that we get this right and make sure that this legislation will really be able to, you know, help us in creating a fairer and more equal society.
Yeah, so sorry, just curious for the both of you, because the title of the paper, you know, Beyond Fairness, I think it has to be quite intentional. How did you all come up with the title? How do you feel it summarizes the paper?
Yeah, we chose this title because we don't think the concept of fairness can be used as the crux of the legislation without discrimination also being explicitly defined. You know, it's the government is calling this legislation a workplace fairness legislation. So, you know, it is important to define what fairness is as well. So I would say, if let's say there's a hypothetical basket of rights that everybody has access to, fairness would be about distributing those rights to everybody equally. And the right to not be discriminated against is one of these rights that everybody should be accorded. So basically, you know, anti-discrimination falls under that umbrella of fairness. It's important that both of these concepts are defined and considered. Also, fairness, it's not just about equity. It's also about making sure everybody is treated justly and ensuring that there is process and outcome impartiality as well.
And also just to add on to that distinction that Apurva shared, you know, the idea of treating everyone justly. I think it's interesting that this idea of fairness has also been contrasted with the concept of justice by this established legal scholar Richard Dworkin, who suggests that, you know, fairness really is a question of what is fair or what is better in the eye of the majority, in the eye of you know, the community. And that might not necessarily be what is just, right? Because what is just appeals to certain objective values that we hold dear. So I think in this regard, I know it's quite interesting that the Singapore government is very, it really likes this idea of fairness. Because, you know, if you look at legislations around the world, you know, you have the UK Equality Act. You know, in Australia, in Hong Kong, they have a slew of discrimination legislations that are, you know, termed Sex Discrimination Act, or, you know, the Disability Discrimination Ordinance. So it's quite an explicit, it's quite a well-established legal concept, you know, this idea of discrimination, this idea of equality. But fairness really isn't such a defined idea. So it's quite curious why we are calling this legislation a Workplace Fairness Act, when, you know, in the National Day, in a 2021 National Day rally speech where the Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong announced this legislation, he explicitly referred to this as an anti-discrimination legislation as well. So I think it's important for us to really kind of build on that very long history of discrimination jurisprudence around the world and just really stick to what works.
So something the both of you have alluded to so far, especially in the beginning, is this notion of a more comprehensive scope, right? And this is from what I understand, or it's been explained to us, that the Tripartite Committee's interim report, Darrell, proposes to protect workers from discrimination based on marital status, pregnancy status, and caregiving responsibilities. But the thing is, there are, in a sense, omissions related to sexual orientation and gender identity, which, you know, you added that the interim report uses the category of sex. So maybe speak to us, or speak to those omissions and how it relates to AWARE's position paper in that sense.
Yeah, sure. I think as a starting point, AWARE's position paper, of course, calls for, you know, the inclusion of sexual orientation and not specifically gender identity, but gender identity as it is understood within the larger category of gender. So that this legislation will protect the LGBTQ community as well. But there was a recent exchange of forum letters where the Ministry of Manpower seems to suggest that it is not planning to take this step, that sexual orientation and gender identity will not be protected characteristics under the new legislation. So the reasons provided in that forum letter are not particularly convincing, in my view. One being that, you know, they have not received many complaints of discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity, and therefore it's not a problem that needs to be addressed through legislation. But the problem with that, I think, is twofold. One being that TAFEP guidelines in the first place never made it clear that people who are LGBTQ are protected under those guidelines. So if you know, me being a gay person, I didn't know that the guidelines would protect me, why would I make a complaint to TAFEP, right? So there's that problem with people not reporting these cases, even though they obviously do exist. So that, I think that the second point really is just the fact that, you know, we repealed Section 377A just very recently, and there was this proclamation by the government saying that, you know, LGBTQ people are part of our community, that they should be protected, they should not be discriminated as well. So the fact that, you know, LGBTQ people may not be protected under this legislation seems quite inconsistent with that message that the government was sending with the repeal of Section 377A. And one last point, I think, is there was a recent Chicago Law Review paper that looked at the effect of what happens when you legislate or when you make clear that a certain characteristic is protected under discrimination legislation and when it's not. And it found that, you know, when a characteristic is protected under legislation, it sends a signal to the community. It helps to reduce stigma and discrimination against that group of people who have that protected characteristic. And what's particularly important here is the fact that the opposite is true, which is that when a characteristic is not protected, it sends a signal to the community that discrimination is condoned or discrimination is accepted as a matter of law. So I think it's very important that we consider this issue carefully in terms of what are the implications if we do not, you know, explicitly recognize sexual orientation and gender identity as protected characteristics under the legislation.
And so moving on, but alongside those concerns with sexual orientation and gender identity as well, one of the other recommendations in the interim report is to, and I quote, allow religious organizations to make employment decisions based on religion and religious requirements, right? So what is the general take on this? I mean, I'm quoting directly from the report itself, but I'm interested to hear how this was formulated and decided. Yeah.
Maybe I'll take that as well, Apuva. So I think it's clear that of course an exception should be made, and such exceptions have been made in legislations around the world. But the question really is how broad this exception should be. So in the interim report, the recommendation was to give religious organizations the discretion to make employment decisions based on religion and religious requirements for any job role. So I think that is perhaps a little too broad, because a religious organization might have roles which will require that particular person belong to the religion. So we might think of, you know, being in the board of directors, or, you know, being in the leadership of the organization. Or perhaps if they are playing a role where they are teaching, you know, the religious doctrines or the religious teachings to the congregation. I think those are fine. And so in the US, that's called the ministerial exception, right? So I think an exception that is, you know, more narrowly drafted would perhaps be more appropriate, because you wouldn't want to give religious organizations, however well-intentioned it may be, you know, carte blanche to make employment decisions in any way that they want, right? So I think one example here that comes to mind is this controversy, I think sometime in 2013 or 2014, involving a church that had dismissed a pregnant employee because she had become pregnant as a result of an adulterous relationship with another employee in the organization. So in a case like that, should the religious organization be allowed to, you know, act in contravention of, you know, existing employment laws regarding, you know, the dismissal of a pregnant employee? And so I think that's just one of the perhaps more extreme examples, but, you know, we were just talking about LGBTQ people as well. Would a religious organization be permitted to then say, I'm not going to hire any LGBTQ people because that is against the teachings of our religion? You know, that creates a really big problem. So I think it's important to try to be as clear as possible as to why this exception is being made, and to make sure that the way that this exception is drafted addresses that concern. Right. I think right now to say that, you know, they are allowed to make any employment decisions for any job role is perhaps a little too broad. And maybe just to close this off, to bring this to a more general point, I think in the AWARE position paper as well, we did suggest that an exception should be made for situations where there is a genuine occupational need. Right. So in the case of that ministerial exception that I was just talking about, that will fall within this more general exception where, you know, there is a genuine occupational need for the job role to be filled by somebody of that particular religion. And there are other examples in relation to other kinds of protected characteristics as well. So I think one very common example is, you know, hiring women to run, say, for example, a domestic violence helpline that serves women, right? So insofar as this general exception is something that should be included in the legislation, I think that's something that we can all get behind. But to, you know, give a particular type of organization absolute discretion and to kind of exempt them from the legislation entirely, I think that might be a little troubling.
Just wanted to touch on another one of AWARE's recommendations, which is that victims of discrimination and harassment who have experienced severe psychological distress should be exempt from going through mediation before they bring their case to the Employment Claims Tribunal. And MOM responded to this, and basically they said, and I quote, they prefer to resolve disputes through mediation rather than litigation. And this practice should continue. So maybe this question is more for Apuva. So what were the cases that AWARE has dealt with, you know, that motivated this recommendation? And maybe you could share a bit while maintaining as much confidentiality as you can.
Yeah, I definitely think that mediation can be a very re-traumatizing process for many of our clients. You know, discrimination and harassment can lead to very significant and long-lasting psychological distress. I think a lot of people tend to respond to instances of workplace discrimination and harassment with very simplistic solutions, like, you know, just resign, just move on. But the humiliation and the severe blow to somebody's self-esteem that happens when they experience these issues, it's really quite severe, and it does not leave you just because you physically exit the environment. So, you know, when it comes to discrimination, these victim survivors are being told that they are not good enough, that fundamentally they are flawed. And that's not an easy thought for them to just get over and move on from. So of course, you know, when our clients have to face the people that cause them these anxieties, and, you know, sometimes this happens during their pregnancy, which causes a lot of physical distress to them and their child as well, it is very difficult for them, and that's very understandable. So we have had quite a few WHDA clients who were yelled at, they were called names, they were threatened with lawsuits at their mediation sessions, with no emotional support, no intervention provided to them. One of our clients had to go through this while she was heavily pregnant, and another one of our clients had to go through this while she was already experiencing severe postpartum depression. Along with that, there is actually a time limit to file for mediation at the Tripartite Alliance for Dispute Management, or TADM. It has to be within 1 month of your last day of employment, or it has to be within 2 months of the birth of your child if you were wrongfully dismissed while pregnant. So this means that that's not nearly enough time for these victim survivors to emotionally heal and process what has happened to them. You know, our clients who face sexual harassment, they have an especially hard time arguing their case effectively without breaking down emotionally in front of sometimes their perpetrator or sometimes the employer that enabled this harassment to continue for them. So I think that these instances really motivated us to make that recommendation.
Just to kind of add also from a policy perspective, I think the government's concern is minimizing costs for both the worker and the employer. But I think mandatory mediation might not necessarily achieve that goal, because in some cases, mediation is quite clearly not going to work. So if, you know, we do go ahead with making mediation the first step for a person to seek recourse, then perhaps we should also create an exception for situations where it's quite clear that mediation is not going to work. So, you know, in some of the examples that Apurva mentioned, I think those are situations where I think an exception should be made, because it's just not something that is going to result in, you know, a settlement, in parties being able to walk away from the mediation. It's just going to eventually lead to further litigation, you know, whether it's at the Employment Claims Tribunal or in the civil courts eventually, you know. So I think at the end of the day, coming from my perspective as a lawyer, mediation is something that's supposed to be consensual. That's, you know, at the core of what mediation is really about. So it's rather almost like an oxymoron to say that mediation should be mandatory. And I think as well intention as it may be to, you know, help parties reduce costs and find a way out of, you know, what is obviously an unpleasant situation for both sides, I think it does not necessarily have to be something that is forced upon every single, you know, aggrieved worker who is trying to seek recourse for the discrimination or harassment that they have faced.
Great. Thanks for those insights, you know, into what goes on behind the scenes, or like what goes on a deeper level, you know, when we talk about mediation versus litigation. We want to dive a little bit, you know, into the core issue of discrimination, you know. And so, Daryl, you wrote in an article for JOM, you know, titled, Will Singapore's New Workplace Discrimination Law Be a Win for Equality? And you wrote that Singapore conflates discrimination with nativist protectionism, and that Singapore citizens, you know, technically don't face discrimination when they are not prioritized in the hiring process. So first, maybe you could tell us a little bit what you mean by nativist protectionism.
Yeah, so basically, nativist protectionism just refers to, you know, the policy approach where companies are required to give preference on the basis of citizenship or residency to local workers before, you know, looking abroad to hire a foreign employee. So this is not particularly controversial. It's something that happens in almost all other, you know, advanced developed economies. So for example, you know, in the US, to apply for the H-1B visa, an employer needs to show that it could not find an American employee, right, who is qualified enough to do the job. And that justifies why they are looking for a foreign employee who requires this H-1B visa. So in Singapore, we have this same policy, right, which is called the Fair Consideration Framework. And this Fair Consideration Framework is considered as part of the Ministry of Manpower's, you know, focus on building inclusive workplaces. And, you know, it characterizes an employer's failure to, you know, comply with the requirements under the Fair Employment Framework as committing some sort of discrimination against Singaporeans. But that's not really what discrimination means, right? Discrimination means, you know, you treated two candidates and you treated one preferentially on the basis of their nationality. That is what is wrong, right? But in this case, that has become what you're supposed to do, right? So that kind of warps the entire concept of discrimination, which, you know, going back to the first point that we discussed, is perhaps why the government seems rather reluctant to use the concept of discrimination as the anchor of this legislation, preferring the rather more amorphous concept of fairness. And I think this can really be traced maybe about a decade back to the 2011 general elections, when, you know, xenophobia, anti-immigration sentiment was really strong, and section titled Protecting the Singapore Core. And that's when this whole idea of nativist protectionism was folded into TAFEP's ambit. But going back a couple years before that, when TAFEP was first set up in 2006, it was something that was, you know, strongly promoted by then Labour Member of Parliament, Halimah Yacob. And it was meant to address the problem of ageism at the workplace. That was really how TAFEP started. So from ageism, it became this focus on, you know, whether Singaporeans are being treated quote-unquote fairly at the workplace. And then now we have this forthcoming legislation, which if you look at the 2021 National Day Rally speech by the Prime Minister, it's actually under this subheading called Work Pass Holders, which is a rather strange place for you to be announcing an anti-discrimination legislation that obviously will apply to everyone, not just work pass holders, right? But it really demonstrates where the motivation for the enactment of this legislation is really coming from. I don't think it's really driven by this motivation to protect minority or marginalized communities. I think a huge part of it has to do with addressing the growing anti-immigrant sentiment. And this legislation is just really that latest step in this long slew of policy measures that have been taken to try to show the people that, yes, you are being taken care of. But ultimately, I think we need to be clear exactly what this legislation is supposed to do. And if it's really about discrimination against people on the basis of characteristics that they cannot, you know, they cannot choose, you know, whether their race, their age, their gender, their sexual orientation, gender identity, disability, then I think we need to really separate these two parts and move this nativist protectionism to where it rightly belongs, which is immigration policy. It does not belong to the Manpower Ministry, so that we can be clear what this legislation does and we can, you know, put in a definition of discrimination that another aspect of the legislation, you know, the fair consideration framework would not, you know, fall foul of.
And, you know, to make sure we touch on as many bases as possible as well, we've talked about a range of different forms of discrimination. I think the final one, which you want to kind of focus on, is looking at indirect discrimination, right? So in the report itself, in the paper, AWARE recommends that the government adopt a definition of discrimination that includes both direct and indirect discrimination, right? And I think it's interesting because, you know, AWARE and Milieu, there was a survey that you conducted in 2022. You found that the most common form of discrimination is indirect discrimination, where company policies and practices resulted in a particular disadvantage suffered by workers because of their personal attributes, right? So to help us kind of orient and round up this conversation today, help us understand what is meant by and help folks understand what is meant by indirect discrimination, and give us a few examples of what folks would see or experience as indirect discrimination, and you know, what it would mean by, you know, having that encompassed in that definition of discrimination.
Yeah, I would say that direct discrimination is probably what most people think of when they think of discrimination. It's when, you know, somebody is singled out and treated unfavorably because of a particular characteristic like race, gender, age, so on. With indirect discrimination, I think it's not as clear cut. On paper, it can look like an innocuous policy that is, you know, fair to everybody. At WHDA, for example, one of our clients, she was faced with a policy that disallowed all employees from wearing religious headgear. And she was the only person at her company who wore religious headgear. So according to the company, this was done for the sake of professionalism. And on paper, it seems fair to have a universal policy for all employees to adhere to a dress code. But this has a disproportionate impact on employees of certain religions. And I think another example would be, let's say if all staff are required to work full time in the office from Monday to Friday, 9 a.m. to 6 p.m., without any exceptions or ability to change their hours if they need to, even when the business would be unaffected by this change in hours or location. This has an impact on people who have family and caregiving responsibilities, who need these flexible working hours to comfortably manage their professional and personal lives. And, you know, when there is a company policy like that, that could disadvantage certain employees, they should provide reasonable accommodations for those employees, as long as, of course, their business is not negatively impacted by those accommodations. So for example, in that earlier example, you know, those with caregiving responsibilities for their children, if they have to pick up their kids from school, you know, they should be allowed to leave work earlier if possible. And, you know, if that's within the realms of the company to allow. And also the provision of reasonable accommodations, it's a special benefit to workers with disabilities. And I think it can really address the unemployment and underemployment of people with disabilities.
Yeah, just to kind of add on to what Apurva, you know, shared, the last point on the importance of reasonable accommodations for disabled people, I think the very serious problem of unemployment and underemployment for disabled people is something that the government has said that they are taking quite seriously. And it's one of the key plagues of the Enabling Master Plan 2030 that was published not too long ago. But I think what's interesting is the fact that the Enabling Master Plan makes no mention of this forthcoming workplace discrimination legislation. And I think you can compare that to the white paper on Singapore women development that was also published not too long ago, which, you know, made a really big deal about this forthcoming legislation. So that's quite strange. And I think it has to do with the fact that perhaps the government is not really looking to use this legislation to address disability discrimination, of which a huge part is the denial of reasonable accommodations to disabled workers. So an example of that is can be really straightforward. For example, if the workplace is just not accessible to a wheelchair user, right? And they need to readjust the workspace so that a person using a wheelchair can, you know, move around. A blind worker who requires a screen reader on their laptop to be able to review documents. Those are just like quite straightforward examples of reasonable accommodations that will really help a disabled worker be able to, you know, participate in the workforce, you know, to be able to contribute meaningfully to the economy. This issue actually came up in Singapore's first periodic review before the Committee on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities at the UN. So this is a human rights treaty that Singapore had ratified in 2013. And one of the obligations under this human rights treaty is actually to enshrine the right to reasonable accommodations. So the committee actually asked the Singapore government whether they were planning to do so, but the government didn't really commit to a position. And I think that's pretty troubling, given that the interim report doesn't really make very much mention of this issue of reasonable accommodations as well. So just to really kind of drive home the point, I think reasonable accommodations are really important, kind of to ensure that, you know, everyone has equal employment opportunities, because we don't all start from the same starting, we don't all come from the same starting point. Some people require more support and others may not. But that doesn't mean that we should, you know, leave people behind just because they need some additional support. And this is something that doesn't just help disabled people or women. It's something that, you know, can also help minority groups generally. So for example, I think something that's taken for granted is Muslim workers who may need time off to do Friday prayers or even just to do their 5 prayers in a day. That's, you know, really an example of a reasonable accommodation and something that, you know, not all Muslim workers may have had the ability to do, you know, for a really long time. So the if we were to enshrine the denial of reasonable accommodations as an instance, as a type of discrimination, I think that will really help us to move towards, you know, our ideal of becoming a truly meritocratic, a truly multicultural society that embraces diversity.
I will add before Isaac asks the final question that this episode is coming out after one that we've done with Max So, who is the research and policy manager of the Disabled People's Association. And in that conversation, he spent a fair amount of time talking about reasonable accommodations as well. And so folks can listen to that too. Yeah, Isaac, see us out.
Yep. So just to end off, you know, the episode, for listeners who have, you know, been listened to this all the way, and at the end of this episode, they've realized that, hey, I've experienced discrimination at work before, you know, what recourse do they have? And also for listeners, you know, who feel inspired, you know, after listening to both of you and wish to get involved in anti-discrimination advocacy, how can they get involved?
Yeah, so if you have faced discrimination or harassment at your workplace, you can reach out to WHDA. Our helpline number is 6777-0318, or you can email us at whda@aware.org.sg. And if you want to bring up your concerns with regards to the upcoming legislation, please email or meet with your MPs, and definitely look out for public consultations that will be held before the legislation is tabled. You can also write form letters about your thoughts and concerns on workplace discrimination to the Straits Times or the Voices section in Today. If you want to stay up to date on what Aware is up to, you can follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. And you can read the full position paper, Beyond Fairness. It's linked in the show notes. And you can find other commentaries and articles on Aware's website as well.